Our feature interview is with Philip Limbury. He is the CEO of the leading farm animal welfare organization, Compassion in World Farming, and also a prominent commentator on the effects of industrial farming. He has recently published an in-depth investigative book called Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat, which looks into the many facets of industrial farming around the world and dissects them for scrutiny and consideration. This book discusses the gamut of effects of the industrial farming processes from animal welfare to health impacts to environmental, political, and economical factors involved. It is extremely well-researched, as is Philip himself. And so we are fortunate to have him here today to speak to us about some of the issues that he raises in the book. Hello, Philip, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me along.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us about your newly released book, Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat. I've been reading it wholeheartedly this week and have been taking in a lot of information as a result of your few years of research that it took to put the book together. The subject matter of this book ties in perfectly with your job as the CEO of the organization Compassion in World Farming. Can you start by just telling us a bit about what Compassion in World Farming is and does?
Yeah, Compassion in World Farming is a leading specialist in farm animal welfare. We advocate for a better deal for farm animals. We are campaigning to end factory farming. So we want to bring an end to things like battery cages where hens are kept in cages so small they can't stretch their wings, veal crates where the calves can't turn around, and gestation crates where the pigs throughout their pregnancy, again, can't turn around. Those systems, we believe, should be banned, and we push for better systems. We want animals to be kept in free-range conditions where they can feel fresh air and sunshine.
And you wrote a whole book about this and a lot more. In the book, at the very beginning, you actually touch upon the origins of how factory farming came to be, which I found really interesting. I wonder if you could expand on that and tell our listeners exactly how and when the world's nations went from raising animals on small family farms to the predominant factory farm model that now exists. This is a piece of important history that I think a lot of people really don't know about.
It all started in the Great Depression in the 1930s, and the U.S., out of for good intentions, passed the first farm bill in 1933, and this was really to help out farmers, particularly corn growers, that were having difficulties, you know, struggling in the marketplace. And the farm bill brought in a subsidy system, a system of subsidy and intervention, which meant that the farmers had a guaranteed market for corn and that any surplus was brought into intervention, into storage by the government. So what this meant was there was no longer any break, any ceiling on production. So corn production went through the roof, and corn became so cheap that you may as well just feed it to animals. And that was the origin of factory farming right there. What then happened was the Second World War came along, and during the Second World War, two things happened. One was there were munitions factories, obviously, churning out weaponry. When the war ended, those munitions factories were repurposed to produce large amounts of artificial fertilizer because the ammonia ingredient was the same. So from bombs to artificial fertilizer, what had also happened is that the Germans, during the Second World War, German scientists had tested nerve gases on insects for the purpose of killing people en masse. For whatever reason, they did not use those in battle conditions. But after the Second World War, that same technology was used to use the first mass-produced pesticides. So from weapons of mass destruction came the capability for mass production. So that combined with this whole new way of feeding corn, people food, human edible crops to farm animals gave birth to industrial farming, which then started to spread around the world.
Well, thank you for that. It's International Respect for Chickens Month right now, so I would like to talk about the hens who play a major part in providing food to the masses. And you say that you are fascinated with birds and their freedom, so I'm especially interested in hearing your thoughts about the chickens raised for food in today's society. For our listeners who aren't yet aware of battery cages and the conditions they consist of for the chickens, can you first tell us a little bit about those, please, and then impress your thoughts about these battery cages to us?
When I was a little boy, my granddad encouraged me to watch birds, and I became absolutely fascinated. From very early on, I was very switched on and alive to the natural world around me, and particularly the birds and other animals around. And the one thing which really, really blew my mind was the whole idea that little birds or insects or other animals could travel great distances on migration. You know, birds would open their wings and they would leave my hometown in the UK and they would end up somewhere in Siberia. Just was absolutely fascinating. And then by the time I was in my mid-teens, when I was at college, we had an outside speaker came into to our class from an organization I'd never heard of before called Compassion in World Farming. And that speaker, a gentleman called Chris Aston, he told me and my classmates about how our food is produced. He told me about battery cages for laying hens, where the cages are kept in conditions so small they can't even stretch their wings. And they're kept like that for life. And that just set me on a whole new lifetime path. I just felt, you know, these animals that should be free, that should be able to stretch their wings, birds that, you know, in the wild would cover quite some distance, were here spending their whole life standing with less space than you would find on the average sheet of typing paper. And I vowed that that had to change. And by 1990, by the time I was 25, I got a job with Compassion in World Farming, and I joined an organization that had been founded by a farmer, a dairy farmer, an organization that its raison d'etre was to get hens out of cages. And you know what? What I felt was I thought it was a crime. I thought, my goodness, why don't the police get down to those farms and arrest the farmers, get the hens out? That's how I felt then. That's how I feel now. The great news is that in Europe, after 30 years of hard, long campaigning, we've seen those barren battery cages, the tiny cages with nothing but wire, banned throughout the European Union. Unfortunately, we still have what they call the enriched cage, which is not great, but it means that there is some hope. You know, those hens at least have some decency in their life. And the better thing is that many more hens are now being kept in free-range conditions where they can enjoy fresh air and sunshine and stretch their wings. And so that to me is a big deal.
So I know in speaking with people in the industry, you have mentioned, you know, these chickens are suffering because that seems to be pretty common knowledge among you and me. But you've been challenged. People have said to you, how do you know that these chickens are suffering? And how do you respond to that?
Yeah, that happened to me in 1994, and it's in the book Farmageddon. What happened was I was on a government committee visit to a new type of cage farm where the cages were just as small for the hens, where they couldn't stretch their wings, but they had perches in them, just a simple perch. And this was supposed to be some kind of revelation. And at the end of being shown around it, I was, you know, gobsmacked that people thought this was a real advance. And I said all of the reasons why the hens in those cages would suffer. And the government vet who had accompanied the visit said to me, Philip, I agree with much of what you've been saying, but how can you say that hens suffer? And I thought, my goodness, here is a vet at a government-sponsored welfare committee visit asking whether hens suffer or not. How could I justify that? And I thought, well, I could see the irony in that if this guy really didn't think that hens could suffer, why on earth was he on a welfare committee? What would be the point? But the other aspect to this was that it showed how difficult it was to make headway when all too often those who justify factory farming would justify it on the basis of they're only animals and, you know, how do we know they suffer or feel pain anyway? But the big breakthrough came when we got successful campaign one in Europe to get animals recognized as sentient beings, a legal recognition of the fact they could feel pain and suffer, and also if we let them have feel a sense of joy and well-being. That was in 1997, and I'm so thankful that we won that battle in Europe, because ever since then, there has been no debate about whether hens can feel pain and suffer, because they do, and now the law says so too.
Thank you for that. I'd like to talk about fish now, which is also covered in your book, and I really learned some points about the fishing industry that I didn't know before. When I read statistics of how many animals are farmed each year in Canada or the U.S. or worldwide, these numbers always exclude the fish, so I think they're often forgotten. And they're excluded because, as far as I know, there are no numbers that track how many fish are killed each year for consumption. So without this type of information, I just think that the whole subject of fish farming goes widely unknown. Can you tell us about fish farming and the conditions that the fish are met with in the industry?
Yeah, well, thankfully, the conditions of factory farming on land are becoming better known, and the big problem is too many animals in too small a space. That's what causes the cruelty. That's what causes the environmental problems. That's what causes the disease problems. Well, the sad news is that factory farming is taking to the water, and fish farming is proliferating around the world. And the problem with fish farming is pretty much the same thing. Too many fish in too small a space. That is why those fish swim in incessant circles, because they're frustrated in living in a barren environment. That is why the sea conditions, if they're in a sea cage, becomes polluted, because all the muck from those fish carpets and deadens the seabed. That is why you get disease problems. One of the big problems in salmon, for example, is a little thing called sea lice. These are little tadpoles that look innocuous, but they're not. They eat the skin and the scales of the fish, and they can get so bad that they can eat the head of the fish right down to the bone, something known as the death crown. Now, where this becomes even worse is when you have, as is often the case, fish farms located offshore in the mouth of rivers, and so wild salmon that are migrating into the sea swim past these fish farms that can have up to 500,000 fish on them. And if they've got sea lice, the sea lice problem can radiate out, and the wild salmon that have no natural immunity to it, the young salmon can pick up these sea lice, which can, of course, lead to the decline in these little fish.
Also, much of the fish being farmed is actually going to feed farmed animals, which I read about in your book. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Well, what's actually happening is that people think that it takes pressure off the sea if we farmed fish. That couldn't be further from the truth. It takes between 3 and 5 tons of wild fish to produce 1 ton of farmed carnivorous species like salmon, trout, halibut, and cod. And how that works is that, well, when I was doing the research, I traveled to Peru. And the Pacific coast of Peru is a hugely rich, diverse environment with huge stocks of fish, or at least that's how it used to be. Unfortunately, over the last 60 years, industrial fishing off the Peruvian anchovy has led to great declines in that species and the animals and birds that are dependent on them. 60 years ago, people tell me, if you walked out onto one of the seabird islands, the guano islands, where the seabird muck is harvested for organic fertilizer, if you walked out onto one of those islands, the sky would turn black. Such would be the weight of birds. I actually went to those islands as part of the research for Farmageddon, and I walked out and I was heartbroken It was like a desert. The birds, the seabirds, barely formed a tideline ring around the base of the island. Why? Because the fish that they depend on have been scooped out, ground down into fish meal, and sent to feed factory-farmed fish and other animals in Europe and in China. I was devastated.
Wow. Another interesting topic covered in your book is with regards to the role of veterinarians in the animal agriculture industry, particularly those employed at the slaughterhouses. And this is something that isn't just widely talked about, so I really appreciate you writing this chapter in your book. From your research, what have you discovered to be the reality for the vets who work in the abattoirs?
Well, in general, people look upon vets as the custodians of animal care, the animal champions. Sadly, in places like slaughterhouses, and of course behind the closed doors of a slaughterhouse, animals are at the most vulnerable. What I found is that all too often the veterinarian spends 90% of their time not looking after the welfare of the animals that are being killed, but actually looking at the dead animals, looking at the meat, looking at the meat quality. It's all about hygiene and food safety. There's nothing wrong with that, but hey, you know, if a vet is there to look after animal welfare, then they damn well should be looking after the animals, not looking at dead meat, right? So that really saddened me. And what I also found is that some in the veterinary profession are complicit in supporting industrial farming, in factory farming. Why? Because they sign off on the veterinary drugs, the antibiotics, that are used to prop up the bad system. So what is wrong with factory farming? Too many animals in too small a space. That's what causes cruelty. That's what also brings about the disease-ridden conditions. Animals in factory farming conditions would not be able to survive. The system would break down if they were not fed copious amounts of preventative antibiotics. How much antibiotics are fed to factory farmed animals? Well, globally, half the world's antibiotic use is used on farm animals. In North America, that can be as high as 70 to 80% of all antibiotic use is in farm animals. It's no accident that North America just happens to be the most heavily intensive, the most heavily industrialized factory farming of animals worldwide. So I should say I'm not against using antibiotics to treat genuine disease incidents, but using it to ward off disease in a fundamentally unhealthy system is not good for animals. It's not good for people either, because it gives rise to antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And the World Health Organization has now repeatedly said that if we don't do something to cut down antibiotic use in farming and in human medicine, then we could be looking at a post-antibiotic era within a decade where currently treatable diseases will once again kill.
So in the slaughterhouse environment, it's about speed, efficiency, and the bottom line, right? And mistakes happen. It's really difficult to, you know, humanely stun and slaughter so many animals on the line that they need to get through their quota. And you say in your book, the vets, they cannot afford to antagonize their clients by accusing them of cruelty, albeit institutional. To do so would be professional suicide. So it really seems like it's a system that in which they're trapped. They either agree to be part of this system that is just this vicious cycle of not really looking after the animals, or they just decide not to do it at all.
Yeah, I spoke to Jean-Claude Atif, who was a French vet working in a UK slaughterhouse, and he was on the night shift. And what he found was, what he noticed was that there was a problem on the slaughter line, which needed to be dealt with. Some things were too close together. I think carcasses were too close together, which could have meant some disease contamination. And he went to stop the line. He did stop the line, and he was threatened at knife point by a drug-crazed slaughterhouse worker. And that really freaked him out, because not only are the animals behind those closed doors are the most vulnerable, but so are the vets too. So we've got this really, really unhelpful situation. Closed doors, nighttime, people under pressure to kill vast quantities of animals in the shortest possible time. And if the line gets stopped for any reason, then those people in that slaughterhouse can face getting lower money or shorter breaks or both. It's just such an awful situation.
In the book, you have a chapter called $100 Hamburger, and I want to talk about that because it's something that, you know, it comes up on the internet now and then, talking about the true price of meat, but I think most people are unaware of the details involved in that. You reported that Chandran Nair, an Asian environmentalist, has voiced that the price of factory-farmed meat will have to rise dramatically to correct the huge discrepancy between what consumers pay and the real cost of production. So why is the true cost of a $4 burger really more like $100?
Well, what he's getting at there is that we pay for our food three times. So-called cheap meat, you pay across the counter, that's the first time. Then the second time you pay through your taxes that go into the subsidies and other incentives that encourage factory farming. And the third way is through the cleanup cost to the environment and to our health. So just giving you a European statistic, what really amazed me when writing Farmageddon was finding out that 85% of the artificial fertilizers used in Europe are used to grow the feed to feed factory-farmed animals. And the cost of that, the beneficial value of the artificial fertilizer to the agricultural industry is up to 100 billion euros a year. What really astounded me was to find that the cleanup cost, because that artificial fertilizer, that nitrogen, it gets into waterways, into rivers, into lakes, it gets into the air and causes pollution there. We pay in Europe as taxpayers up to 150 billion euros to clean up the environmental problems attributed to that. You know, up to 50% more we pay for our taxes than the entire value to the farming industry.
So you've mentioned governmental farm subsidies, and I'd like to talk about that as well. Can you explain the role that they play in funding the animal agriculture system to allow consumers to pay the cheap prices that they do for meat when they're buying their meat from the grocery stores?
Well, 60 years of government policy and subsidy in the Western world, in North America and in Europe, have gone into encouraging farmers to go down the industrial route, the intensive route. That has led to a distorted marketplace where it's actually harder and less profitable to do the right thing, to farm in a proper way where the animals are kept on the land, and to do it without lots of artificial fertilizer, and to do it without pesticides, and so on. And so what Farmageddon arguing is that we need to reappraise that. We need to have a food system rather than a farming system. And that food system that needs to be based on quality food for all, instead of, you know, lots of cheap factory farmed food that actually is bad for the countryside, is bad for our health, and makes it harder to feed a growing little population.
And then in your book, too, you also say it might be cheap at the point of sale, but it comes at a high price to the animals, and that's certainly true.
It comes at a very high price to the animals in suffering. It also comes at a high price to the countryside. It's no accident that over the last 40, 50 years, once common farmland birds, bees and butterflies have suffered drastic declines in the wake of the industrialization of the countryside. It's also no accident that, in general, food is getting more unhealthy. Meat from grain-fed animals, factory-farmed animals, is higher in saturated fat, lower in omega-3s and other health-giving nutrients. So it doesn't do anyone any favors. And the big irony is that the biggest threat to rural livelihoods and employment in the countryside is industrial agriculture.
So in your travels all over the world, what are the similarities and the differences that you've seen in industrial farming practices? I was actually quite surprised to see that, for example, you travel to Taiwan and Argentina, and they're using factory farming systems there. But I'm interested in knowing the comparisons that you've seen with regards to similarities and differences.
Well, I wanted to see factory farming at its most extreme. And for that, I went to California. We're in California's Central Valley, and we stood amongst vast monocultures of crops, fruits, almonds, every crop imaginable. And when we stood amongst the perfectly regimented rows of trees in the almond groves, I said to my co-author, Isabel Oakeshott, just listen. And you know what we heard? Nothing. Not the chirp of a bird, nor the buzz of a bee. They're all gone. The ecosystem had broken down. We took to the air in a small plane to look at this vast patchwork quilt from up there, and what we saw were things that looked like vicious scars on the landscape. Those were mega dairies, up to 12,000 cows standing on a single muddy paddock, not a blade of grass in sight. I wanted her to see that because that's what some see as a vision of the future. That's what some see as this so-called sustainable intensification. It is not a vision of the future. It is, to my mind, farmageddon. Things are different in Britain and Europe, generally speaking. European farmers are relative novices at industrial agriculture. We still have a lot of our cows and sheep on pasture. You know, sadly, many of our chickens and pigs are still reared indoors, but some of those are outdoors too now and in growing numbers. But there is growing pressure on European farmers to take up American-style hyper-industrialization. And that's why I wrote Farmageddon, because if we don't do something in Europe quickly, then we too could have a countryside that looks more like California, that is peppered with mega dairies and battery feedlots, GM crops, and perhaps animals if we let it. So, you know, the bad news, to my mind, is that U.S.-style agriculture is being exported around the world, and it is uprooting sustainable land-based farms where the animals are kept as they should be, on grass, feeling fresh air and sunshine.
Yeah, you say in your book, with industrial farming often comes an attitude that animals are mere units of production, a means to make a profit. From reading your book, it seems to me like that is a global attitude. What's your take on that?
I think you're right. I think that animals are often just seen as commodities, as goods, as widgets, and factory farming takes that to its natural conclusion. That is why we felt it was so important to get a legal recognition for animals in Europe as sentient beings capable of feeling pain and suffering rather than just goods. And I think that if we are going to be true to ourselves as a civilized society, then we've got to recognize that animals have needs and wants, that they're, what happens to them matters to them, that their lives are their own. You know, they're not just units of food production. And what we can see is that taking that inverse, taking that animals are just goods, are just products, to its natural conclusion of factory farming, brings about its own justice, if you like, that it destroys the countryside, it makes food unhealthy, it turfs farmers off the land, and it helps to make people in poor countries worse off to the point of starvation by failing to recognize and respect the sentience and the intrinsic, the inherent nature of animals. We are doing ourselves a disservice to.
You say that people should be informed about how their food is produced, and they need to remove the blindfold that hinders so many from truly exercising the consumer choice that is their right. You know, we need to exercise our consumer power and not be ignorant about our food. What are your thoughts on that?
Society does not make it easy to be a compassionate consumer. It does not make it easy to exercise our right to choose. And I think that's wrong. I think that what we do need is we need honest labeling. We need labeling which is absolutely clear about how the meat, milk, and eggs are produced. And until we get that, we are going to be hampered. We are going to be like shoppers with blindfolds. We're not going to be able to exercise our choice, and that is wrong.
Well, thank you so much, Philip, for coming on the show today to speak with us about some of the findings in your new book, Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat. To find out more about the work that Philip does at Compassion and World Farming, please visit the website ciwf.org.uk. And I do encourage people to go out and get the book, Farmageddon. It's a really, really interesting read. Thank you, Philip. Have a good day.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. So much. It's a pleasure. So much is a pleasure. So much is a pleasure.